You're now watching Around the Horn, the weekly internationalist news update with author and historian Gerald Horn.
Okay, today is October 23rd, 2024. We welcome everyone to the weekly series entitled Around the Horn, which is the internationalist news update with Gerald Horn. Gerald Horn currently holds the Morris Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Gerald Horn is an activist, scholar, researcher, archivist, author, historian, attorney, and much, much more. Dr. Horn has written at least 48 books. Dr. Horn's latest book is entitled Armed Struggle, Panthers and Communists, Black Nationalists and Liberals in Southern California through the 60s and 70s. Dr. Horn is also a permanent guest on the radio show The Horn Report, which airs on Black Power 96 Radio on Sundays at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And Dr. Horn also hosts a radio show entitled Freedom Now, which airs on KPFK 90.7 FM on Saturdays at 11 a.m. Pacific. And replays of both shows can be found on the Activist News Network. Dr. Horn, thank you so much for coming back on the show, and welcome back to Around the Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Dr. Horn, as we go around the horn, again, we wanted to talk about the BRICS summit taking place this week in Kazan, Russia. One of the major focuses of the summit has been de-dollarization. It seems like the U.S. sanctions and tariffs campaign against countries that won't bow to U.S. hegemony has not only backfired against the U.S., but has turned into a self-inflicted wound as countries that aren't even currently facing the direct U.S. sanctions are looking to de-dollarize in case they ever end up on the wrong side of U.S. imperialism. But Dr. Horn, what should our audience know about the BRICS summit taking place this week in Kazan?
Well, first of all, this summit in a predominantly Muslim part of Russia is potentially a game changer. What I mean by that is that it illustrates one of the major reasons why we do this program. What I'm suggesting is that as an outgrowth, perhaps, and I underline perhaps, of this summit, involving, in the first instance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, it may have substantial impact upon those of fixed income in the United States of America. Those of fixed income, speaking, for example, of those who manage to survive on Social Security checks or SSI checks, or those who are enduring stagnant wages with not a realistic possibility of a hike in wages. Because with this BRICS summit and what you've already bruited in terms of de-dollarization, this privilege that U.S. imperialism has enjoyed, that is to say, with in return for receiving automobiles or electronic gadgets or French wine, you turn over pieces of green paper, speaking of the greenback, that kind of system may, an underline may, be screeching to a halt. And instead, you have a substitute for that. Now, we all know, just to issue a cautionary note, that this is not going to happen overnight. It's an elongated process. However, there will be signposts amongst the way. For example, the so-called petrodollar system, whereby oil, a precious commodity, which you fill up your automobile tank with in terms of gasoline, is sold by the Saudis and others in return for dollars. Already, you see that system beginning to unravel. For example, the deals that China has been negotiating have involved exchanging Chinese currency. And there may not be a day far distant when people in the United States will be scrounging around for retbacks, to use the colloquial term for the Chinese currency, just like people outside of the United States scrounge around for greenbacks, speaking of the US dollar. We also see that with regard to trade amongst the BRICS nations, which by some measures already has surpassed in economic terms the group of seven, the United States, Canada, the Western European nations, plus Japan, that the trade between amongst the BRICS countries and those who are seeking membership which include such giants as Turkey, for example. President Maduro of Venezuela is at this Kazan meeting. The Prime Minister of Vietnam is at this meeting in Russia. And so already you can begin to glimpse the outlines of a new alternative trading system that is not as dependent upon the dollar. And once again, I must reiterate, this will have dramatic and significant impact upon the U.S. working class and the poor if their currency that they depend upon begins to devalue. You know that I once lived in Zimbabwe, and after the United States imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe, what that meant was that people on fixed income began to suffer tremendously. And that is the prospect that we in the United States may face unless, of course, we can turn this ship of fools around. And just as a footnote to this talk about the BRICS, we all know, at least reliable and frequent visitors to this program know, that we put forward an analysis that suggests that over the past 75 years, U.S. imperialism has battered from pillar to post Black internationalists, left-wing internationalists. You see that even today with the prosecution and persecution of the Uhuru Three, and that has led to a decline of internationalist thinking. I'll never forget what happened in February 2022 when a prominent Black nationalist leader in the wake of the special military operation of Russia and Ukraine argued that he too was, like Washington, opposed to the SMO because he said he was against white power wherever it manifested. Now, I won't go into a long argument or articulation about what was misguided about that particular point, only to suggest that historically, you've had many in the United States who have misjudged the Russia question. And what's interesting about that is that if you go back to Marcus Garvey, when you had the Bolshevik Revolution, at least he was able to interpret that as a split amongst what he would consider to be the white powers or the European powers, what we would call the North Atlantic powers. But by February 2022, that kind of argument had dissipated. And another straw in the wind in that regard, you see 5 days a week in the White House when you have a Black woman, Karine Jean-Pierre, be the White House spokesperson with regard to domestic affairs. When they turn to global affairs, she yields the podium, she yields the rostrum to John Kirby, a Euro-American military man. And that, it seems to me, betokens how and why it is that there has been this systematic effort to keep Black people in particular away from any sorts of analysis of global affairs. Now, I don't want to go out on a limb with regard to the BRICS. I'm old enough to remember the late 1970s when you had the Iranian Revolution, the Nicaraguan Sandinista Revolution, Grenada Revolution, you had the progressive changes in Afghanistan. We thought that time was up for US imperialism, but they came storming back from behind, as many in our audience know. And so it's not beyond the realm of imagination that they could pull off the same trick again, particularly as the bourgeois commentators have suggested, there are contradictions within the BRICS. Iran and Saudi Arabia are part of the BRICS. But of course, we know that until the rapprochement brokered by China, they were at sword's point. But then again, if you turn that coin over, you'll see that the latest news is they're talking about having joint military exercises in the Red Sea, perhaps in conjunction with Egypt. Speaking of Egypt, we know that Egypt and Ethiopia are part of the BRICS, and we've talked numerous times about the conflicts between Egypt and Ethiopia. And so that could be a landmine for the BRICS, the fact that you have these internal contradictions. I should also mention that if they accept more members, one has to worry about the ability of the organization to lose coherence, to lose the possibility for consensus, and particularly, as we'll note in a minute, if they admit Turkey, which is involved in so much double dealing, is dizzying. And they'll probably bring that mode of operation into the BRICS. And that could be an effective landmine for North American imperialism. However, having said that, there are some positive signs. For example, you might have noted the referendum in Moldova, the neighbor of Ukraine, a former Soviet republic. It was expected that there'd be a landslide in favor of aligning with the European Union. Instead, it barely squeaked by, and that may be an indication that countries like Moldova, symbolizing other countries too numerous to mention, may be doing a calculation, suggesting that the time is almost up for North Atlantic imperialism, and that there is a stronger horse now on the track. Speaking of the BRICS, it reminds me of the miscalculation that the Iraqis under Saddam Hussein made in 1990 when they intervened in Kuwait, feeling that given the Cold War premises that Moscow, the Soviet Union, would intervene on their behalf to protect them from U.S. imperialism. They had not calculated about the change in Soviet policy under Gorbachev, which led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union the following year. And so it's possible that countries now see the BRICS in the passing lane. And that, of course, is potentially highly significant. So let's just stay tuned. And let's also push to make sure that U.S. imperialism is not able to destabilize the BRICS, not to mention destabilize the member states of the BRICS. And of course, that should be high on our list of priorities.
Thank you, Dr. Horn, for that answer. For some reason, my camera cut out again. I did want to note that in my reading of the news, over 30 countries requested to join BRICS. And I also wanted to mention a quote that I heard you state yesterday on, I believe it was the show with the comrades in China called Beatbox, B-E-T-T, not Beatbox, Bet Beat. I keep messing it up. Wherein you stated that President Lula says, every night I ask myself why all countries have to base their trade on the dollar. Which I thought was an illustrious quote regarding this BRICS summit. But Dr. Horn, as we go around the horn, we also wanted to ask you about the entente between China and India. The news came on the eve of the BRICS summit that India and China have reached a deal regarding their border dispute during ending a four-year military standoff between the two nations. Dr. Horn, considering the fact that these are two of the largest countries in terms of both population and emerging economies, and that India is supposed to be a major strategic partner in U.S.'s war on China, how significant is it? Is this entente?
Profoundly significant. And it may be an outgrowth of the BRICS, just as you are correct to suspect that the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia comes as they're joining the BRICS, although, of course, we know that the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia sent his foreign minister to Russia for reasons that remain unclear. But in any case, this entente between New Delhi and Beijing will have significant impact on the international community and the global correlation of forces. First of all, with regard to U.S. imperialism and its diabolical plans to destabilize the People's Republic of China, they had been relying very heavily upon New Delhi. New Delhi was a linchpin of the so-called Quad, US, Japan, Australia, for example, and of course, an associate membership, if you like, of the Republic of Korea or South Korea. But with this apparent entente, rapprochement between these two giants, US imperialism may have to rethink the entire Quad. It'll have impact with regard to India's relationship with Pakistan, with which it has crossed swords more than once since independence in August 1947. Of late, the relations between China and Pakistan have had a downturn, and this may be an explanatory factor of why China's moved to improve relations with India. You've probably seen the stories of Chinese workers being attacked in Pakistan, a rather unstable country, to put it mildly, with nuclear weapons, no less. But there's a so-called Baluchistan independence movement, which is organizing by leaps and bounds and has been attacking Chinese development workers. This entente may have an impact on Japan, which is bet heavily upon this relationship with the U.S. imperialism, and also has bet heavily on its relationship with India, a relationship that arguably stretches back thousands of years to the founding of Buddhism. I'll never forget reading and actually writing about the Tokyo war crimes trials of 1945, putting the leaders of Japan on trial for various war crimes. There was an Indian judge on the judicial panel, and the judge actually stood up when the Japanese defendants came into the courtroom, which was symbolic of India's friendship with Japan, and also of this idea that this was a kind of victor's justice, which was quite prevalent in New Delhi at that particular moment. And so with Japan's reliance upon India to confront China, Japan may have to rethink. Obviously, it burnishes the reputation of Russia, which is close to both China and Japan. I noticed at the BRICS summit that President Putin referred to what he called Chinese comrades, interestingly enough, which was redolent of the days of the former Soviet Union, for example. And it's not a term that Mr. Putin oftentimes deploys in terms of state-to-state relations. It may also portend, at least I hope it portends, a similar entente rapprochement between other members of the BRICS, speaking of the conflict between Egypt and Ethiopia. And I think it also presents a challenge to us in the United States of America, because I think that with this improved relationship between India and China, you can expect more negative publicity in the U.S. press about India, which in many ways would be well deserved, because as critics of the BRICS and of India have pointed out, the BJP ruling party in New Delhi is no prize. They're fundamentally a Hindu chauvinist. But at the same time, the challenge to the progressive forces will be to try to maintain some sort of critique, particularly of their Islamophobia in New Delhi, without falling victim to the latest propaganda trick of U.S. imperialism. And in this context, let me raise the conflictual relations between India and Canada because of credible charges that Indian envoys in our northern neighbor have been involved and murderous attacks on what is likely the largest Sikh population outside of the Punjab. This has led to a downturn in relations between Ottawa and New Delhi. There is a similar case being pursued in the United States against Indian envoys as well with regard to anti-Sikh attacks. We're going to have to maintain vigilance with regard to those particular investigations. But with regard to Canada, I would warn our northern neighbors that they may be in a more perilous position than they recognize. Now they have negative relations with India, Russia. For example, they've been in the vanguard of supporting and supplying the Kiev regime, and also China. Recall that Ottawa cooperated with U.S. imperialism in detaining an heir to the fortune and leadership of Huawei, the major a Chinese electronics company. She was detained for months on end, and then China in return detained two Canadians for months on end. And so with those negative relations that Canada has with three major powers, Russia, China, and India, it's going to make them more dependent on U.S. imperialism. I think it's going to have an impact on the Canadian elections for next year, may pave the way for the Tories to return to power. It may lead to more reliance upon U.S. imperialism. And I would like to also warn our Canadian friends that for centuries, ever since 1776, there has been an ambition of the United States to absorb Canada. That was what the War of 1812 was all about. And so now, with Canada in this parlous diplomatic position, I would just recommend that our Canadian friends proceed cautiously with regard to their relationship with the United States of America. And I could also mention, if I had time, the impact of this India-China rapprochement on Vietnam, with which China has had complicated, complex relations, to put it euphemistically, and that has led Vietnam to embrace India in return. Of course, it has impact on Taiwan, and you may have noticed that China's put more pressure on Taiwan in recent days and weeks, and of course it'll have impact on Australia. So the inference you should draw from this rapprochement, among others, should be that it underscores the importance of Russia, which no doubt played a role in bringing these two powers together. And it also suggests that these two Asian giants are at the fulcrum of the global correlation of forces. And when they move to embrace each other, it has gigantic ripple effects all around the world. And once again, for those looking for good news, here you have great news with regard to what appears to be this entente between New Delhi and Beijing.
Thank you, Dr. Wong, for that important and comprehensive answer. As we go around the horn, we also had a few questions we wanted to ask you about West Asia. First, while there's been much coverage of the U.S.-Israel war on Palestine and Lebanon, with a growing focus on Iran, there's been less of a discussion about the other conflicts in West Asia that are directly or indirectly connected, such as the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which also involves Russia, Turkey, Iran, Israel, and of course the US. Dr. Horn, what should our audience know about these other existing or brewing conflicts and issues in West Asia that are getting less attention, but add to the growing tinder that could spark World War III?
Well, first of all, with regard to Israel, I'm sure many in our audience are following the distressing news about what's going on in Gaza in particular, and in southern Lebanon in particular. There has been loose talk in Israel about reoccupying Gaza, which sheds light on this genocide that's unfolding, on the starvation, apparently intentionally, that's being inflicted upon the Palestinian population. I oftentimes joke that I watch the programs of some of these Israeli hawks who inevitably speak with U.S. accents, curiously enough, such as Caroline Glick, who has been raising the specter of late that Phil Gordon, who would be the national security advisor in a Kamala Harris administration, has curious ties to Iran, she says. In other words, it's sort of a throwback to the Red Scare, or a throwback actually to what we see today with regard to Chinese American politicians being accused of being in the pocket of Beijing. You probably saw that article in the Wall Street Journal just today about Congresswoman Grace Meng of Queens, who is being accused of being a kind of Chinese agent. So we should be careful with regard to that. And she also charged a number of leaders of the Pentagon are fundamentally Iranian agents. And recall that Robert Malley, who was a negotiator of the nuclear accord during the Obama years, is now under investigation because of supposed untoward relations with Tehran. And at the same time, we see on campuses a crackdown on student protesters, student activists. That's why it has not been as much in the news this fall as it was in the spring. It's extended to faculty, according to an article in the New York Times that should appear in the print edition tomorrow. We see the crackdown on Radio Sputnik, and full disclosure, I used to be a regular guest on that particular network, which broadcasts on the FM dial in Washington, but is no more, has been ousted, the crackdown on the Uhuru 3. So we have our hands full right now, fighting the good fight with regard to this tragedy and crisis in West Asia and Israel-Palestine in particular. Now, with regard to Azerbaijan, many in your audience are probably familiar with this longtime conflict between mostly Muslim Azerbaijan and mostly Christian Armenia. The Turks, who have stepped into the fray, recall that both Armenia and Azerbaijan were former Soviet republics. And after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, of course, the contradictions emerged between the two, and Turkey, with its usual double-dealing style, not only has stepped into the fray on behalf of Azerbaijan, and that helps to explain why Azerbaijan was able to oust Armenia from the contested territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, but also in terms of double-dealing by the Turks. We now know that Azerbaijan is a major supplier of petroleum to Israel, despite Turkey being the big brother in Baku. And full disclosure, during the Soviet days, I was able to visit Baku, which I think I talked about on that program we did on the Activist News Network. And so here you have Turkey talking out of one side of its mouth about disrupting trade relations with Israel, hosting Hamas leaders, but at the same time, standing idly by, if not encouraging, Azerbaijan supplying petroleum to Israel. And here's the real kicker, that if Israel attacks Iran, which is suspected, the attack may be launched from territory under the jurisdiction of neighboring Azerbaijan. That's part of the double dealing of the Turks in the first instance. You see that also, as we know, with regard to their supplying drones to Ukraine and engaging in trade relations of a robust nature with Russia. This is the sort of double dealing that the BRICS may have to endure if they accede to this full-fledged member of NATO, the U.S.-dominated military alliance, entering the BRICS. It may be worth more headaches than BRICS can now endure.
Thank you, Dr. Horn, for that answer. And the other question we wanted to ask you about West Asia is how should we be analyzing the lethargy and comprador role played by many of the leaders of the so-called Gulf Arab states, particularly of the Sunni majority countries? On the one hand, one could argue that many of these leaders are rightfully fearful that if they get involved on the side of the Palestinians, they too will end up facing the genocidal wrath of the U.S. and Israel, which in addition to Palestine and Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, and countless other nations have also faced. On the other hand, their lethargy and in many instances, affirmative comprador role has been beyond shameful. And to throw something else into the mix of this question, Dr. Horn, who is Mesut Boulos and how does he factor into this overall analysis?
Well, when I read about the Boulos family, which is a multi-billion dollar family with their fortune built in Nigeria, of all places, although they are of Lebanese origins, and as you see from that picture, they are also in-laws of one Donald J. Trump. Tiffany Trump has married an heir to the Boulos fortune. And what that reminds me of is something we should not forget, which is that there's been a certain element in the Arab community that has been quite comfortable colluding with and collaborating with U.S. imperialism. We are all familiar with the Saudis. I've made reference to the United Arab Emirates. Their leader was in the Oval Office just a few days ago before showing up at the BRICS meeting in Kazan, Russia. If you look in this hemisphere, you'll see that there's a Arab comprador class that's quite busy in West Africa, not only Nigeria, but Liberia, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, even Haiti, for example. Going south, you may recall that a former leader of Argentina, Carlos Menem, was of Syrian Lebanese descent. The current leader of El Salvador, of Arab descent, the richest man in Mexico, Carlos Slim, of Lebanese descent. And recall that when the New York Times was having a difficult patch a few years ago, he bailed them out, believe it or not. And what's interesting about that, just as a footnote, is that so in a sort of pro forma manner, the New York Times, after he lent them a good deal of money, did a sort of negative takedown of him. But that was years ago. They haven't had a word about him since then, interestingly enough. I guess they did that to sort of, as they say in the United States, CYA, to cover their butts in case anybody would make accusations about them. And with regard to the UAE, we've talked many times about their noxious role in Africa, particularly in Sudan. We've talked about the so-called Abraham Accords, brokered by Mr. Bush, where countries like Morocco and Bahrain sold out the Palestinians on behalf of relations with Israel. And so once again, the question we'll leave the audience with is this, to circle back to the beginning, will the rise of the BRICS and their stiff challenge to North Atlantic imperialism, will it disrupt this rather comfortable relationship of some forces in the Arab world with imperialism, a relationship, by the way, if we had time, we could stretch back centuries.
Thank you, Dr. Horn, for that comprehensive answer. And I know we're over a minute over time. Once again, we thank you for coming on the show. We look forward to talking to you next week. We thank the audience for tuning in and for their excellent comments in the chat. And we look forward to speaking with everyone next week on Around the Horn.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people. Power! Power! Power to the people! Power!